Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Three Questions. I'm your host, Andy Richter. Today, I'm talking to Nasim Pedrad. Nasim is an actress, comedian, and writer. You know her from SNL, New Girl, or her current show, Chad, which she also created, writes, and stars in. Season 2 of Chad is out now on the Roku channel. Nasim joined me live in the studio. We had a great conversation, and she's really a lot of fun. Here she is, Nasim Pedrad. What was the genesis of the show? Like what?
Well, I did SNL like 2009 to 2014.
Did you not know?
What? Nobody told me that.
And I left with Mulaney actually to
his
sitcom, which honestly was like such a great lesson early on in my career of you could just have the most incredible pedigree around a project and sometimes things just don't last and they don't come together. And at that point I'd already left SNL where, you know, I was just starting to have so much fun there. And I was like, well, it doesn't make sense to go back.
Yeah.
I think I'm really ready to like create my own thing. So Chad has been in the works for many years of my life.
Yeah.
I got a development deal after Mulaney ended. And yeah, basically they were like, well, what show do you want to write? And I'm pretty sure it was with 20th with Fox. And I'm pretty sure they expected me to write a show where I'm a girl in my 30s dating
right,
in a big
right,
city.
Right.
And I was like, what about this totally weirder idea?
I'm a boy in my teens.
Yes.
Not dating.
Yes. And yeah, it sounded and probably was very scary. And yeah, and this is before Pen 15, which, oh my gosh, another show that I really, really love. So they just kind of like, they weren't sure about it. And then I just got lucky. This show has been like the little engine that could. They let me shoot it. And then ultimately they were like, this feels like a cable show. So then it went to TBS and now it's at Roku.
Yeah. I'm the king of having an idea that I never do anything with. And then I see something that's like similar and I'm like, well, shit. Now, when you saw Pen 15, did you go like, oh, no?
Well, yeah, it was funny because I had started Chad, but again, it was like held up going from 20th to TBS for a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the show has just been lawyers
waiting,
going back
waiting,
and forth,
waiting,
deciding.
Waiting.
Yeah. Where to put it. And Pen 15 came out during that. But, you know, it's that show is so special and original and it felt different enough. But once I cracked the character of who Chad was and I figured out what the comedic engine of the show is and the comedic dynamic between the characters, I really believed in it. And I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to bet on myself. And obviously, until I get to an absolute no, the show can't exist, then I'll pivot to something else. But
right.
As long as it looks like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, I'm just going to, you know, stick by my vision. And
yeah.
I was lucky that I got to.
Did you get a lot of pushback for stealing a job from a male actor?
There's
so few jobs out there and you stole one.
It's so funny. There was so much like... people took umbrage with that before the show
did
even
they really?
Came. Well, they were just, the people were so not sure of what it was like people were like, is she making a show about trans people? Is it? I'm like, no, I'm just like earnestly playing this little boy.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And honestly, I mean, I love writing about the awkwardness of adolescence, but I really felt like as an adult woman, I could disappear into looking like a 14-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more than I personally could have with a girl, because you have the wig and the eyebrows and his posture and everything. So I just felt like a very fun character to play. But we would do these like focus, what are they called? Like, you know, the test screenings.
Yeah, focus groups. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And,
focus, you know, test screenings. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd like hear some of the feedback, and most people fully got it and yeah, were into it. But there would always be a couple people that were like, now, is this fair to young boys? Or like, or some people that were just like, is this mean to trans people? It's like, he's not trans.
Yeah,
he's,
yeah,
he's just, wow, a boy. Wow. But yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What was it that you think like that urge to be like, I want to be a boy. You know, I want to play a boy in a show, you know, because it is, I mean, I can see the appeal of it just being fun, mm-hmm, you know,
yes,
because teenage boys are, I mean, people that are messes are funny,
mm-hmm,
and there's not much bigger mess than a teenager,
than
especially
a strong
teenage
but
boy.
Wrong 15-year-old
yeah,
boy. Yeah, I mean, honestly, like I, you know, the origin story of even wanting to make this show, I think when I graduated from theater school, there was just so much negative representation of Middle Easterners. I really wanted to create a half-hour comedy centered around a Middle Eastern,
mm-hmm,
family with a really fun character at the center of it that was written from a place of empathy and humanity and that was nuanced and had flaws, but,
yeah,
you know, flaws that were relatable rather than this person's operating a terror cell, which was most of the auditions I was getting,
sure,
after theater,
yeah,
school. And so when I started like thinking about the character, yeah, I don't know why my truest essence as a child is resonant with that of a 14-year-old boy, but I was definitely a huge tomboy growing up, and
uh-huh,
I was much like Chad, a very late bloomer.
Uh-huh.
I just was, all the other kids were lapping me in every regard when it came to like social aspects of being in high school,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and I desperately wanted to fit in, and so there's so many things within the character that were very true to my upbringing,
yeah,
obviously aside from being an actual boy. But yeah, I kind of just wanted to tell this coming of age story of this awkward immigrant kid,
yeah,
who's trying to navigate his freshman year of high school. You know, I think teenagers are already struggling to find their identity and to fit in, and then as an immigrant kid, you're sort of caught between these two cultures, and
yeah,
it becomes this like extra obstacle to get,
yeah,
through, you know, in assimilating. You're also assimilating at the same time that your parents are,
yeah,
and, you know, they're learning about prom when you're learning about prom.
Right,
and
right,
so
right,
it's a shit show. And it's sort of, it felt like a good, you know, kind of foundation for a coming of age story.
Do you know a lot of teenage boys?
Well, I grew up with all boy cousins, and
oh,
coming from a big Persian family,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
there's so much
you
emphasis
rely on the cousins.
The,
yeah, yeah.
There's so much emphasis on the community, and you're,
yeah,
always with each other. And so that probably steered me into my tomboy phase for,
right,
sure. Like,
right,
we would just watch Rocky Balboa and beat the shit out of each other afterwards for sport. But really, yeah, and obviously, like, I've once I started doing sketch comedy and The Groundlings and then SNL, I've certainly trafficked in playing young boys,
yes,
before.
Yes,
so
right, right, right.
It wasn't super outside of my,
yeah,
wheelhouse. But
every, you know, like slight comedy woman,
yes,
got to be a boy every now and
at
then.
At some point,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, throughout history, I think that's probably the case, you know.
Yeah, I,
yeah,
mean, yeah. So when I think once I started figuring out the character and leaning into like what his idiosyncrasies are, it just really felt like I could really disappear into it more as an awkward boy than as a girl. And I was talking to this incredible writer, producer, my friend Lee Eisenberg, who he was just like, why don't you just go for it? Like, just make that show. Make the show that you're going to have the most fun,
yeah,
doing. And yeah, I'm really grateful to him. That sort of set me on the path of being like, fuck it, I'm just going to pitch this.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Cool. Now, you were born in Tehran, but your family moved here when you were a baby. How old were you when they moved here?
My parents actually met here studying abroad, and then the revolution happened in Iran, and so they went back to basically
have a baby.
Yeah, and then skate right away. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to basically wrap up their life there. Obviously, they didn't want to stay in a country where church and state weren't separate. Yeah. And so basically, they went back, had me there. You know, this is like post-revolution Iran. So my mom remembers like not that many people being at the hospital the day I was born, because literally so many of her friends and family were in prison at the time. I was like truly horrifying chaos and unrest. And my dad's brothers were imprisoned at one point. So he had to get out of the country. So he was there when I was born, but he had to leave. So my mom with a newborn baby wrapped up their life. He was able to come back with his student visa, but like by the skin of his teeth. And and then my mom and I ended up in Germany for 6 months. And then I kind of met my dad again when I was 3 years old at LAX.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. And this is obviously before FaceTime and before. Yeah, yeah. So it was so, he was kind of a stranger to me. And then I remember when my younger sister was born, he was like so enamored with her as a baby. And I was like, God, why is he so obsessed with this kid? He just never had a one-year-old before. Yeah, he had never experienced a two-year-old. So it was all very new for him. But
do you remember there being a reacclimation? Like, oh, now this guy's here. You know?
Yeah.
Was there that kind of,
well, apparently,
I mean, I'm saying that because as we were talking before we started recording, I married somebody that had a kid, and there definitely was like, who the fuck is this guy? Even though, you know, she was two.
Yeah.
But there was like a lot of like, wait, I got to do what he says too?
Yeah. I mean, we have actual pictures of it at LAX where my dad is like trying to hand me like a toy that he got.
And right, right.
I'm just pushing him away. Like, who is this stranger? And then apparently, like, on the flight from Germany, I'd befriended this Chinese family that had, like, two kids. So there's all these pictures of me at LAX with the Chinese family and then other ones of me just, like, shoving my dad away. Like, I want nothing to do with you.
Yeah, who are you?
Let me get back to my people from this flight. Yeah, but then I got to know him, and he's the best.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people understand the trauma, you know, the trauma of immigration and the things that come with that. I mean, I feel like that's growing up. But yeah, my parents, I actually really watched them struggle for a lot of my life. And honestly, I credit a lot of where I'm at with, you know, the grit and resilience that I developed as a result of seeing them struggle and seeing them, you know, have to start from scratch and their work ethic and all of that. It definitely lit a fire under me, I think, from a young age of like wanting to make it, wanting to be able to take care of them, wanting to be able to do what I love. And to their credit, my parents were not very traditional Persian parents. They were very progressive and supportive of me following my dreams. And they were like, listen, we moved to this country so that you can be, you know, sort of limitless.
So they're more
in the
like
opportunities.
On the secular side of
very much so. And much like many people in Iran right now that are fighting for their freedom.
Absolutely.
And they're fighting to put an end to this oppressive regime.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my parents were like, we want you to have, you know, you can do anything you want here and go for it. You know, they didn't push me toward, you know, the more traditional paths of like law school or medical school. And so I'm so grateful for that. I never had to like combat that piece of it. And luckily it worked out.
That is like, and I mean, not just an Iranian immigrant story, but it's such an immigrant story of like, you gotta be a doctor, lawyer, you know, like,
We didn't come here, like, we didn't almost die and escape a revolution so you could do sketch comedy.
Improv.
Exactly.
That's not improv. Please, not improv. When you got here at age three, did you speak Farsi or?
That was my first language is Persian, and I sort of learned English from school and I Love Lucy and TV, really.
Did you have did you have a little accent when you were little? Like,
oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean,
that's so cute.
Now I'm so good. I was full ESL. English is a second language. Like, Yeah. And that's sort of when the outsider otherness starts to that seed gets planted, which then ends up, you know, being such a part of my identity and including the things that I make creatively, tap into that, you know, sort of origin story, I guess. But yeah, I feel so grateful. It's crazy to think of the sliding doors of life. Like, what would my life have been had they not left?
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I'm incredibly grateful to them.
Did they meet in California? Were they in school in Southern California?
Yeah, they were at UC Berkeley. And then really had every intention of raising a family in Iran.
Yeah.
But when the Shah was overthrown and Khomeini took over, that was a non-starter for them. I mean, they didn't want to be somewhere where militant Islamic extremists are running.
And how did
they
end up in Orange County?
They moved to Irvine because of how great the public schools are there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, again, great decisions on their part, wall-to-wall good decisions on mom and dad's part. We got a great education and went to great schools. And then I was able to go from my high school in Irvine to UCLA, where I studied theater.
Yeah.
And I really, at that point, I knew how much I loved to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And UCLA was sort of where I honed in on my skills as a writer more, mm-hmm. which ended up really launching my career. I feel like, again, like once I graduated from theater school, there just weren't, like, no one really knew what to do with me. I was like ethnically vague. There weren't many parts for people that, you know, might have this weird name. And so I sort of figured out if to get the parts I want to get, I'm probably going to have to create them myself. And so, yeah, I started writing. I did The Groundlings and then wrote a one-woman show that Tina Fey saw that sort of led to everything. She told Lorne Michaels about me and that sort of, you know, started my career. But before SNL, I was getting small parts on things, you know, and I remember I was always like really going at it, but I also was really lucky in the jobs that I had and the people I worked for. One of my last jobs, I was like a tutor, I was a personal assistant, and one of my last jobs before I was able to support myself full-time as an actor was with a family, this guy, Sam Gores, and his wife at the time, Jensen, who Sam owns Paradigm Agency. And so they were in the industry. They knew I was pursuing this thing. And I'm just so lucky to have worked with such great people. They were always like, keep your eye on the prize. This is your job, not your career. They would let me leave for auditions. They were so wonderful.
That's pretty. Yeah.
So, yeah, I was really lucky in the things that, you know, in those formative years of figuring out how I was going to make it as a performer, I had great people around me that
helped,
made it more possible. Yeah.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
You know, so much of Chad, of the show, is about assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you know, the kid's Persianness, Chad's Persianness is a big part of it, but it doesn't even need like Chad doesn't even need to be Persian to be the awkward mess that he is that just wants to fit in, you know? And it is like, you know, the other kids seem cooler and more at ease, but that's always like I always watch things that are about teens and they're, you know, that like, you have to look at it through as if it's like a teenager lens.
Right.
So it's like everyone else seems cool, but that's not, you're just seeing it like you're seeing Chad's eyes and everyone else seems cooler than Chad.
Yeah.
But, you know, but assimilation is such a big part of it. Fitting in, like, you know, fitting in rocks or what, you know, something that he says. But did you like that does not jibe with being a performer? You know what I mean? So like you're a young kid that's wanting to fit in, but yet you also have the, hey, everybody, look at me, gene, you know? And I mean, was there like a tension between that?
Reconcile when you, those two
yeah,
parts.
Yeah, when you were a kid, when you were, you know, when you started to realize, like, I want to do this for a living and I want to do this, and maybe not even for a living, just for fun. I want to get on stage, you know?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, and there are definitely parts of me that are quite shy and, and you wouldn't think that I'm that comfortable performing, but for me, it's not, it's a little easier to hide behind a character, you know, that's why I love doing improv and sketch comedy. I think early on, I felt like comedy was a bit of an escape, you know, with like the typical traumas of childhood, but also it kind of served as a social currency at school, you know, like I was pretty dorky, but I also felt like, oh, if I could make people laugh, like I have something to offer, I could connect with people that way. And and that was something that developed early on, even, you know, earlier than when I knew I wanted to study theater and pursue it professionally.
Like junior high-ish kids, you start to be like the funny kid.
Totally,
you know, funny girl.
And then in high school, you know, there were places where I could sort of put that, you know, to test, like I had the improv team and doing the plays and, you know.
Improv team. That's crazy to me that there's a high school improv team.
Oh, yeah. We competed regionally.
Gosh.
It was the whole thing. Yeah.
Wow. I blame UCB. I blame UCB for the proliferation.
It's spreading everywhere.
Yes. This virus.
And then, and then at UCLA, we had this really fun thing, this like school-wide talent show that was in the tennis stadium. And in between the talent acts, there was something called Spring Sing you could audition for, which was basically sketches, like sketch comedy in between the different acts. And we felt like rock stars, like to get on the team, then to write, you know, that it was like some of the most fun life memories I have are from that time. And like once you get that bug, you're like, oh no, I don't want to go to law school now. I think law school is
was
just
law school in there. Was it like, I'm gonna go study theater, but law school, mom and dad, don't worry, it's there.
It was only there as a backup plan in the very back of my mind, I think, because litigation just reminded me of performing. Like, you know, so I was like, this might be the closest I could get to performing. But
law and the clergy are both show business.
There you go.
They're both a different kind of show business.
They're cousins, of that same. So like I don't think I was taking into consideration the amount of paperwork and other aspects of law school that make it what it is. But I knew at that point. And then actually a friend of mine from high school recently mentioned that I had forgotten this, but in the high school, in my senior yearbook, we had these things called senior wills where you like write some inside jokes to your friends and you just get like a few characters to say something. And mine had said, see you on SNL, which in retrospect is so delusional. It's a nice reminder that I knew even that early on, like what I loved. And it was a matter of figuring out how to do it professionally,
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And your folks were, when you said theater school, there was no sort of like gulp. There was just, okay.
I mean, I'm sure there was, but they didn't show that side to me. They really, to their credit, are like, go for it. If that's what you love.
And you've got to, I mean, you're mom and dad must be funny because your sister's a comedy writer too.
Yeah.
And was she just a copycat?
She's truly, I mean, she was a prodigy. She was like living in the dorms at Columbia still when she started writing for 30 Rock. Like Nina's,
oh my God.
Nina's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Tina had a lot to do with ascension to being able to do this professionally. But,
well, there's worse mentors to have.
But yeah.
Because at least she got like
she's
a
amazing.
Real, she's, I mean, brilliantly funny and also just one of the most decent, kind, wonderful
totally.
People, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of shits in this industry.
Oh my gosh. A total
and
pro.
She's not
and a
one
total
of them.
Wonderful
yeah.
human.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents were often funny, not always intentionally. They are hilarious. And my dad, incidentally, is now like he's become like a reoccurring character on season two. So,
oh, really?
He fully
your
had.
Your dad is acting in the show.
Yeah. He like had to
oh
join
my gosh.
SAG.
Wow.
And yeah.
Wow. Did you create a monster?
I know. I'm like scared he's going to get a publicist. Not that far from now.
I'm just, in the new Scorsese movie.
Yeah. Like screening my calls to like. Take meetings in general.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
No, he's amazing. He's so funny in season two. Yeah, it was a real labor of love.
Yeah. As you started in, because this industry can, in many ways, chew you up and spit you out,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I mean, did you start to feel that right away? And was there like daunting prospects of like, maybe this is too much, you know?
Specifically around the time of the, or any time.
Any time. Just at some point, you know, like just feeling like,
sure.
oh, I don't know if, you know, maybe law school might be the thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess most of that level of doubt would have been before I moved to New York mm-hmm. to do SNL. I think what saved me from dipping back into that feeling all the time was that I was writing, you know? And
uh-huh.
I feel like, If you can write and create opportunities for yourself, you just feel like you have so much more agency in your career than when I was only acting, you know, early on in my career. I just felt like I'm waiting for someone else to give me a job. And,
yeah.
and that can feel scary and stagnant
right,
for
right.
sure. But yeah, once I fell in love with writing, even just the process of going from having just a kernel of an idea
yeah.
to you're hiring now, you know, these incredibly talented production designers and DPs and all these amazing people that are bringing your little vision to life.
It's been a while since there's been like something that like, hey, what if we did this? And then, you know, people are then scouting locations for it. It's been a while since where it's like, oh my God, they're really going to make this, you know?
The best.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
And I don't know if you ever, I mean, I imagine you ultimately you get over, you know, Hitchcock probably got over it. But, it's like I still, it's amazing
to
me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
No, I don't think that joy will ever
yeah.
Yeah, go. I mean, and when you create a show, like, you know, you get to experience it and as three different creative entities. It's like its own little living thing in the writing phase.
Yeah.
And then it takes on a new shape once it's up on its feet and you're
yeah.
in production. And then again, in the edit, it finds all this newness there. And
yeah.
you have these like three little armies you get to like work with of
yeah.
these crazy talented people that are helping make your vision come to life, and there's just no greater joy. I mean, it's just so fun.
Yeah.
Although it also takes a lot of time to make a show. So I'm excited now that, you know, season two is coming out. It's also fun to dip into a project that you're not responsible for every aspect of and to
yeah.
be a guest in someone else's home.
Oh, absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If you could, yeah, being a guest star can be the greatest.
Number four on the call
yeah.
sheet. What a dream.
Yeah, yeah.
You have days off.
Yep. I love this that you were playing Dora the Explorer at kids' birthday parties, and the note is, and assembled the costume herself. Which is like, oh, you mean shorts and a t-shirt?
Yeah. Costume is a very generous description for
yeah,
what
yeah.
was my baggy sleep shirt and a very
and
shitty wig.
And how did that, like, you know, do you place an ad in Craigslist? Anybody looking for a Dora?
I worked for a really weird company that would place, you know, children's performers at birthday parties.
Wow. And how do you get that job? I mean, is it like a newspaper ad?
A friend of mine was doing it, uh-huh, and it made no sense economically. I'd always like break even with the gas I'd spend going to the party.
Right.
I tried to lean more on personal assisting and tutoring than the birthday gig. But it definitely, I mean, talk about giving you grit. That was a humbling job to do, because sometimes you'd show up and the 4-year-olds did not care for you.
Right.
You'd have to well, buckle up. We have another hour and a half of this.
Yeah, or also in between booking you and the actual birthday party, they moved on to a different show.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah.
Exactly.
Was it just Dora? Did you do other?
No, I think I did some princesses that were also received not as well as I would have liked.
No, having a 4-year-old now,
my costumes were better. I just had the shittiest costumes.
So when SNL happens, is it a pretty standard, like, you go in and, you know, you meet with Lorne and he makes you wait 6 hours, you know, that kind of thing?
There's a template for that experience. But I think part of what's useful about sort of the ringer they put you through is by the time you get the job, you're like, well, how can it be scarier than the last 7 things they made me audition a couple times, and then the audition itself is on the soundstage. So that's sort of, they sort of do that to see if you can withstand the pressure of that. And
they're deeply cruel people. That's the other thing, too.
Maybe they're having some fun with it, yeah. And then I think, you know, the meeting with Lorne is sort of, so you can probably make sure you're someone that people can be around. You end up you spend so much time with each other in those halls, and you're in this washing machine together where you're coming up for air on Sundays just enough to like eat and crash and go back at it on Monday. SNL is like the best game of survival, and it really prepares you for everything to come. I remember Poehler, when I started in 2009, Amy Poehler was like, enjoy it while you're here, because everything after will be boring in comparison.
I can't remember. Was she still on the show?
She would pop in. I met her when she would come in and visit and do some spots. But yeah, it really, going from that to making my own show, I feel like everything is easier after SNL because even when things go wrong in production, like you're rained out or, you know, unexpected things come up, and while the money is being spent, you've seen it, those problems be fixed in such a short amount of time because of SNL that like everything feels easier because you're not live in an hour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So
in that respect, it just makes you kind of leave the show feeling like, okay, like if you can survive that, you can survive.
That's one of the best things about learning to be an improviser and being an improviser is that, you know, what you just said, it starts when you're doing a show and you don't know what you're going to say. You know, you're going to do an hour of comedy for people and you don't know what you're going to say. That I think that I definitely felt that it gave me just like feet that were flat on the floor when I went into kind of new situations that were very exciting and very intimidating. But I was always like, well, I mean, shit, at least I know what I'm going to say.
Right.
You know, they gave me the lines, you know, I mean,
you just build a tolerance for withstanding uncertainty and staying comfortable in that uncertainty and trusting that it'll come together.
SNL is famously, can be a difficult place to sort of, you know, elbow your way up to the table in terms of screen time. Mm-hmm. And what was your experience like
there's only so much real estate on the show.
Writers like you or they don't like you, and they, you know, you get a writer inspired to write for you. I mean,
right. And you know, the writers are the ones that are producing the sketch from the control room. So obviously all the cast members write, but you need someone who's just a writer to have their name on the sketch as well, because they're the ones producing it. Mm-hmm. So you do kind of need to find who your teammate is when you start out. And you know, there was for sure times where I was like, I think I might be too weird for this show, like my sensibilities specifically. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I was also like, I auditioned with all those weirdos, you know? Yeah, but, yeah. And I told them who I was, you know? Right. So I can't remember. I definitely heard either on another podcast, like it was either Jay Farrow or Sudeikis, Jason Sudeikis. Not sure those two have ever been confused for each other, but one of them said that, yeah, like obviously the show sometimes wants to put you in a specific box and you're itching to do these things that are kind of outside of that box.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm so lucky I was able to be there long enough to, I remember like my fifth season, I was starting to like really have fun getting to do some of the characters I had auditioned with and, but then also, you know, playing sort of the, like the Kim Kardashians and the top of show pieces that were also topical and useful to the show. So yeah, again, I feel so grateful to have had that. And at the same time, you're a little bit chasing that high the rest of your career because there's just nothing like it. That adrenaline. And I think a lot of people go on to, at least even if it's like doing shows at colleges or you're just getting that live fix in some way because, you know, you have instant gratification at a place like SNL versus on a television show. You can, you know,
yeah, it goes out into the ether and you hope that people are watching.
You can start and stop and, you know, do reshoots and all that. Yeah.
Did you enjoy, you know, like I think Kim Kardashian, if I'm not mistaken, was probably the character that people, you know, that popped the most with consciousness. Did you enjoy the impersonation kind of part of that, you know?
I mean.
Or would you have just rather played arbitrary weirdos that came out of your own brain?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously fun to do a mix of things. I think I auditioned with Kim.
Uh-huh.
And then she just became, you know, more and more famous right around the time that I was on the show. So it made sense to do her.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I liked wearing different hats. I mean, I really liked playing different characters.
Yeah.
And it sort of just becomes boring if you feel pigeonholed into one specific thing over and over again. But
is that something that would happen periodically?
Yeah,
like where you
well,
go through,
also you're,
you know, a month or two where you feel like, oh, I have to be Kim Kardashian.
I mean, again, it was always fun. I mean, you know, it wasn't like there were people on the show that were true impressionists.
Yes.
And for a lot of us, when we were doing impression, it was like a take on them, you know, you know, and.
Yeah, I can't do impressions. I can do impressions of impressions. But I can't, you know what I mean? Like, like I didn't even know that, like, it was possible to do Christopher Walken
until you saw the impression.
Jay Moore did it at Christopher Walken. I was like, and then it's like, oh, you see the distillation of the you know, like
the
markers.
Yeah. I mean, some people with mimicking, that's like just so their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But it was fun. Like, it was fun. I mean, there's only so much real estate on the show, like I was saying. So you end up writing things that kill at the table read and then don't get in the show. You're also like, you know, oftentimes you're coming from a comedy club or a school like the Groundlings where you're just really writing for yourself. But then at SNL, there's also this component of catering to a host that also has to score and shine. It's really their episode and their show. So I think like early on, I maybe wasn't the best about finding a way to like play my weirdo in tandem with giving them something really fun to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So there's just like all these different components that go into it. But I remember I kind of went into it with a really pretty positive attitude of like, I knew so many friends that had gotten hired and I had worked with that I knew were some of the most brilliant women I've ever worked with that ended up for whatever reason getting let go, that it just felt like there's so much of it that's not in your control.
Yeah.
And, you know, I...
Yeah, and there again, the quality of the work sometimes it doesn't really factor in that much. You know, it's the same thing as like the quality of a show might not be that, you know, might but not be it. There's all kinds of different reasons that things can turn around.
Totally, you know? Yeah. But I really, you know, I think I was having so much fun by the end of it. At the same time, I felt like, okay, what's the next, you know, what's the next phase? And I, for me, that, you know, the next stage was really creating my own vehicle. And I hope to keep doing that. Like, I just love writing something out of nothing and then seeing where it goes.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
What was the transition between SNL and Mulaney like? Like, did,
it
did John?
Quick.
Did John say like, "Hey, I want you to come over here and do this"? And
yeah,
did you hesitate? You know, did you think like maybe I should stay here? You know,
yeah, especially because I was like, "Oh, this season's so fun, and I'm getting to do these recurring characters." And like, I also knew that I'd be itching to come back to LA, like, be on a sitcom, have like get back to my friends and family and to like not be in that grind forever.
Yeah.
So I was a little torn. I mean, John, but obviously I loved working with John so much.
He's
so funny. It was like,
if it's
Martin Short, I was like such a no brainer in so many ways too.
It's hard to say no to John Mulaney.
Yeah.
You know?
And like we had, you know, and we got to do a full season, but we had so much fun, and it also was like another Lorne show, so it felt like a nice transition out of SNL, like still kind of in the family.
But
when we started, I was doing both, so I was like flying back and forth between LA and New York twice a week.
I didn't realize that.
I would like I would shoot the taping for Mulaney on Friday, like I would, and then just like first flight to New York, land and like be thrown into wigs and go to the live show for SNL, and then
and
come right back.
And are they sending you sketches that you get, you know, that like, you know, are you on the plane like trying to figure out?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Or I'd be like in hair and makeup as Kim, like about to go on. I haven't even rehearsed the sketch, and Lauren's like talking to me about how the taping for Mulaney went. It was so chaotic, but it was so fun. It was so fun.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from that, and Mulaney really built a really fun family. And so when that came to an end, I was like, all right, time to do my own thing. I've learned a lot from working on other people's shows.
Yeah.
And I did feel ready at that point.
When Mulaney ended, was there a new season of SNL? Was there a possibility of you going back to SNL? I mean, you mentioned a little bit at the beginning, but we didn't really get into it. Was there the possibility of you going back to SNL and you just opted not to?
Well, what happened was during Mulaney, 20th offered me a development deal.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, if this doesn't continue, we'll pay you for the next thing you want to make.
Yeah.
So I was sort of already in that marriage, and it felt like the right move.
Yes.
Like it felt like
That's the natural progression.
Yeah. Now I'm ready to create my own thing. So it was kind of a seamless transition from Mulaney to, you know, doing the development deal where I ultimately created Chad.
Yeah. Because there is that feeling. I mean, and it always seems to be. I mean, there are a few, you know, Kenan Thompson being an obvious exception, but it does seem like, oh yeah, I mean, and it is like, you never feel like, oh, Kenan, you should move up, because he does do other things, you know, but
for sure,
but there always has seemed to be that, you know, there's a point where you jump off the train and, you know, and get onto another train. And, it seems like it kind of presented itself to you in a way.
Yeah. He's been able to really navigate like being a little more normal and low key while going through that show. Whereas like for most of it, it's just like so intense and crazy that it feels kind of impossible physically and mentally to do forever. But he's found a good groove with it where I think he can, you know, like it's not that disruptive to his,
mental health or happiness. Performer. He's like, there, he just has such a charm, you know, just such tremendous charm that it's like, you never feel like, you know, like,
totally. And the show like really knows how to utilize him to, you know, like other people know exactly how to write for him. It's really.
And how to put him in to just save a bit by charm.
Just cutting just to say, him.
You go
literally
in and be charming.
Cutting to him. Yeah.
And that'll maybe make an ending. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's been, I feel really lucky. I think the opportunities I've had, you know, coming out of that show, I've been properly, you know, prepared for. I've worked enough to know how I want to run a show and how like the culture of the show I want to create and how important morale is, you know, for because you end up spending so much more time with each other than you do sometimes with your own families, you know?
I love hearing you say that because it is something that I don't, in my experience, there's a lot of people that don't understand, especially there is whether you want to accept the responsibility or not, if you are, as you said, you know, like if you're number one on the call sheet, if this is your show, you are in charge of morale.
Yeah.
Whether you want to be or not. And if you absolve yourself of that responsibility, you do it at the show's peril and therefore your own peril.
Yeah.
And so I've, you know, seen it 100 times.
For sure.
Of just like, it's the Terry Johnson show and Terry Johnson's going to be an asshole.
Right.
Like Terry, what the fuck are
you
doing?
It starts with you, Terry.
Yeah, Terry. Yeah. It's really in your best interest to be nice to
people. We've all been on those sets.
Yeah. It's crazy to me.
Yeah. And it doesn't really inspire comedy. That's for
sure. It sure as shit doesn't.
Yeah.
And also it's just like, I don't understand how you can live like that.
Life is too short.
Oh my God. It's so much. I would like the just spiritual exhaustion of being an asshole.
Completely.
Just, I can't even, like, I would just be a wreck, you know?
Not to mention in an industry where we're so fucking lucky.
Fuck yes.
Like, we already won the lottery to be doing this.
You get your, and especially within even, like, the thing that I, you know, having gone to film school, been a PA on commercials in Chicago, you know, and you know, then doing props and all different kinds of jobs, second AD, different things. It's like, in a way that I feel like is very sort of like, on purpose, keeping myself humble is I am a member of the crew. Like I am just, I'm, you know, like to say like I'm not as important, you know, I'm no more important than the guy pulling cable. It's like, well, you know, the guy pulling cable gets the flu. He can stay home and they get someone else. But it is like you're a member of the crew. Yes. But you also like you get your own toilet.
Yeah.
When you're not, when they don't need you, you can take a nap.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
They feed you so well.
You're coddled constantly.
Yes. You're like a baby, you know. And to you know, look that gift horse in the mouth
totally.
Is ridiculous.
I luckily, haven't lost sight of that. And it's still so exciting for me to see. Anytime I see a billboard, I'm like, well, that's another miracle. It's so hard to get things made. It's so hard to like get a pilot picked up, let alone a season of television, let alone a second season.
Oh.
Like,
It's so
impossible that if you lose sight of like how special that is when it does happen.
Yeah. Well, now there was your sort of like SNL to out of SNL, you know, SNL into a network sitcom into your own production deal. Like that was fairly slam bang, you know, like it was on top of each other. And then you kind of, you know, the brakes are, somebody pumps the brakes for you in a way. And how do you deal with that? Like, how do you go from,
oh, the brakes
I'm
have
on
been
SNL.
Pumped
yeah,
so many
yeah.
times. I mean,
yeah.
we were in production, then COVID happened,
yeah.
then the merger happened. Then I think I just, again, I feel like I'm really, maybe again, it was maybe my upbringing of being in a household that felt full of chaos at times where I'm pretty comfortable in chaos and uncertainty. I think that's part of why I was able to survive SNL.
Yeah.
And then I've really just done a lot of work on saying, listen, in life, you you control the controllables and then you let go of the wheel. Like, there's things that are not in my control. I think I'll fight for things to the end and do what I can to honor my work. And if I really believe in something, to make sure it sees the light of day. But that's what gives me peace in my heart. And then if it doesn't continue, then I can live with that, knowing I did everything I could. So, yeah, there are stalls. There are things that slow you down. There are periods where, when my show was going from one network to another, I had to turn down work because had I taken a new show, I'd sort of be betting against myself in a lot of ways. Yeah, so there are lulls.
Even though you were contractually able to, you just decided not to because...
There were periods of time where I wasn't even under contract anymore. I was just taking the president of the network's word for it that we'd be able to get the show. And it always ended up working out. But you have to take risks and you have to be willing to not have everything have a tidy bow on it at the end of it, you know, like to be like, well, I'm not totally sure what the next 7 months looks like. But again, I think because I knew I could always come back to writing.
Yeah.
I was like, the money will come. The opportunities will come. Like, I just have to, all I'm responsible for is being true to myself and making things I believe in.
Yeah.
And that's what lets me sleep at night. And, you know, the other stuff, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm so grateful I got to make these two seasons, and I can't wait to start playing women again and reminding people
that. Are there specific things in the future that you want to do? I mean, work and otherwise, you know? I mean,
you know, making a TV show kind of takes up your whole calendar year because, like, you know, you're in the writer's room 16 weeks and you're in production a couple months and then you edit. But then because of that, and this show in particular spilled into so many years of my life, I haven't really been available to collaborate that much in other projects and work with other people. So I'm looking forward to getting to do more of that. I got to work with Eddie Murphy on the new Beverly Hills Cop movie that's coming out later this year.
Great. And
yeah, it's really fun. It's really fun, like I said, to just be in someone else's sandbox. And
are you actively pursuing that kind of stuff now? I mean,
like for, you know, projects that make sense. I really just want to work with kind, talented people and make things that I love.
Are you thinking of a season 3 of Chad, or are you kind of in a wait and see kind of mode? Or
I mean, again, it took so long to go from TBS to Roku because of the logistics that, like, it might start to look creepy at how much older all the other kids have become than Chad himself. Like, he's in this weird
cryogenic. Oh, that's true. I didn't even think about that.
Like,
wow.
Peter probably looks like a young man, his best friend at this point. Although we do leave him in Europe, so possibly, I guess, ostensibly, he could start at a new school in Paris. I don't know. But I'm definitely, you know, I guess never say never. Who knows? But yeah, the current cast that populates the show is significantly older, those kids, than when we started.
I didn't even think about that. But yeah, sure. Because those goddamn kids, they just keep aging.
Exactly. You know? They're like in their early 20s now.
Isn't there some sort of hormone therapy that can keep them, you know, sealed in Lucite?
Yeah. Chad would be so frustrated. Everyone's gone through puberty but him.
From your journey, what is the, you're opening a book here. Do you have a prep for the final question?
What is my life right now?
Yeah. What have you learned? What do you feel like is the biggest lessons you've taken away from your journey?
Honestly.
I just love that word, journey.
I really, like, when I talk to, like, when I go to colleges or talk to aspiring performers, or honestly just young people that are trying to figure out what they love.
What to do in this world.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that original, but it is very true of not, you know, being afraid of failure and adversity, and that things that might seem so life or death in the moment, especially when you're younger, can really build the strongest parts of your character that end up getting you through tough times once you're an adult. You know, like, I really do think that the things I experienced in my childhood did give me grit. They made me be able to, you know, withstand some of the challenges you feel both as a performer, but also just as a person later in life, you know? Yeah. And so I think even failure, like, you're so hell-bent on something turning out a certain way with your career, and it can often lead you down a path you didn't anticipate, and other opportunities can come from having not gotten that one gig or not gotten that one thing. And to just remain open, just enjoy the ride itself, you know? That's been great. And for me, I'm really, like, gotten really great at being less outcome oriented and more process oriented, mm-hmm. and just appreciating that I get to do what I love.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've read, have you read Rick Rubin's book, The Creative Act, A Wave? I can't recommend it enough.
Okay, I'll
try.
It's
so good.
I might listen to it.
Listen to it.
I have a real attention span
problem. Oh my God, listen to it.
You know,
he reads it himself. He wrote this, I mean, it's as much kind of about spirituality as it is about being a creative, but it really resonated with me. And I feel like I want to just continue to ask myself, what do I want to say about where I'm at in the world or the state of the world? Like, what is resonating with me that is my specific perspective on, you know, obviously for someone like me, I write from such a personal place and from such a character-driven place that I feel like I can always come back to that and you know, who knows what that next character will be, but it's really fun, and I'm lucky to do something I really enjoy.
Do you think that a lot of that comes from just, because I can imagine being the child of your parents, people that, like, had to leave everything and start fresh and start new, that it's like, there's not a lot of room for, like, complaining. You know what I mean? It's like you have a whole lifetime of, like, it's, you know, it's not as bad as it could be.
Oh my God. I mean, like, going from seeing what they had to put up with to where we are as a family now, and the fact that I can support myself as an artist. I'm like playing with the house's money at this point, I feel like, you know, like, it's just so, it's all icing.
Yeah.
And you know, to be able to give back to them has been a dream of mine that I got to see fulfilled. And we got to see that dream fulfilled in one generation. Like, that's so cool.
And
in the last, like, year and a half, I also, given everything that was going on in Iran, sort of threw myself into activism. Mm-hmm. And that kind of work has been incredibly fulfilling. I mean, obviously, it's so personal to me. When the mass uprisings happened in Iran, I think everyone in the diaspora that had some reach or some platform kind of banded together to say, how can we amplify the voices of our people back home?
Yeah.
And that work has continued. I'm lucky enough to have been put in touch with all these different human rights lawyers, and to sort of continue to shine a light on what the people of Iran are hoping for, which is, you know, democracy and freedom and an end to state-sanctioned violence and gender apartheid and all of these things. So having my, you know, professional career has been amazing, but it's also been really cool to use that to be able to, you know, get myself involved in other things I really am passionate about and believe in, like advocacy work. And you have a little bit more access to that when, you know, you happen to be a performer. So
right. Yeah. And it feels like you will be heard.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like, you know, you're playing a teenage boy, but also you can, you know, you're being heard. So you can then say, like, okay, you know, I'm funny and I'm, you know, and I've been in lots of comedies, but also, well, listen to me. You know, if you like me and those things, listen to me on this very serious thing, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes it honestly, I mean, it's a little weird that this is the case, but it's the world we live in. Sometimes it just, being on television helps you get into those doors, like political doors. Like, you know, like, I couldn't believe it when we went to the UN in Geneva. The ambassador of Venezuela was like, "Oh my God, SNL!" Like, I'm like, you watch, like, that's on your radar,
yeah,
even,
yeah.
You know?
That is weird, yeah.
And suddenly it gives you a little, like, a little opening to then have a conversation with them about things you really care about,
yeah.
Like, you know, speaking on behalf of the people in my home country. So, yeah, I think especially since there's such an oppressive regime in Iran and the civic space isn't really open, like mm-hmm. all the opposition leaders are in prison, it's so important for Iranians outside of the country to do what they can.
Yeah.
You know, obviously democratic change has to come from within, but that's kind of been a lot of what I've been doing this last year, and I hope to continue to do it until, you know, something changes.
Yeah. Well, good for you.
Thank you, Andy. I wanted a cookie for that, and you gave it to me.
I never know what to say when somebody's doing something amazing and you know, virtuous. It's like, well, good for you.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, season 2 of Chad is out January 19th on the Roku channel. And
that's right.
Yeah. And Nassim Bedrad, thank you so much for coming in.
You're so wonderful. Thanks for having me.
It was my pleasure. And I will be back next week with more of the 3 questions. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
The 3 questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to the 3 questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's growing? Can't you feel it? Ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.